next session number 31509, Reel 1.
Gavin Douglas, Reel 1. Gavin, could I ask you first of all to tell me something about your very early life? Whereabouts were you born and brought up in your early years?
Well, I was actually born in Tianjin, which in those days was called Tientsin. It's the treaty port for Beijing, which was formerly called Peking.
And could you tell me something about your family?
My father was Scottish, as is obvious from my name, and we have a very long history going back some 800 years, which has been recorded, which is the only reason why I know quite a lot about my ancestors. But that is a typically Scottish trait. We're a small country, and we've always been very proud of our past.
And what do you remember of your childhood in Tientsin?
Well, my first memory or impression of China as a child was the very, very dark winters, which you do suffer up in North China. Snow everywhere. And then after the winters, you get the dusty winds which blow from the Gobi, which darkens the day. As a very small child, I seem to remember always we had the lights on in the house because it was either deep snow outside or there was a dust storm. That's the very first memory. But after that, of course, as I grew up, I remember well being taken by my ama to what was called the Russian Park in Tientsin. It had a big pond in it, which froze over in the winter, and which we could toboggan down a slope onto, usually with an adult, naturally, because we were very small. And our armors used to collect with us every day, and mostly in the afternoons, of course, early afternoons if it was winter time. And we would be all nationalities, children from the French legation, Dutch, German, American, Russian, you name it, they were all there. And we all got on like a house in fire. We could speak to each other because we all had learned a bit of the Chinese Putonghua, which is the servant's dialect of Mandarin. And there was no problem with the languages. If I spoke speaking to a German boy, I spoke to him my few childish words of Putonghua, and he understood exactly what I meant, and it was good enough. So we were all kids together, played and in the summertime and snowballed in the winter and that sort of thing.
Did you have much to do with the Chinese apart from your ama?
Absolutely not, except from the ama and, of course, the household servants. But very little of the household servants. But we did have a certain amount of contact with the children of the household servants, because all the houses were in compounds in Tianjin in those days. And it was your own little sort of area. You go out, and when you went out into what was called the backyard between the house and the kitchens, there were the servants' children playing. And they were the same age as us, older and younger, but all smalls. And we, of course, learned some of our Putonghua from them.
And how about your education? What was the norm with educating sort of British and international children?
Well, there was a private school run by a very good French woman. But this was later on in my life. I don't remember anything about any schools until I was about five or six. Before that, a certain amount of reading being taught me by my mother in our house. But when I was eventually sent to school, again, all the children there were international, really. And I don't really remember very much about it, to be quite honest. Education did fall back, there's no doubt about it. And it was for that reason that my father realized that long before we actually went back to England, that I must be, and not only I, but my brother and sister, should go to England and our education be taken up seriously.
Would that have been the usual thing with British children in China, do you think?
I would say so. Children whose parents were in the same circumstances as my children, yes, it didn't matter, as my parents, this would be the same, for, I think, for the other races, too, but I can't speak for them, but I'm sure it was had to be the same.
Because you were there at an interesting time. Am I right in thinking this would have been the 1920s?
Yes, it was. It was the early 20s. I was born in 1914.
So it would have been after the first revolution, wouldn't
it?
The 1911.
I knew nothing about that at all.
No. I suppose as a child it wouldn't have impinged on you even,
not
would
a
it?
Bit. The sort of things that impinged on me was that the River Wey used to flood every spring when the snows melted. And the water came right up to the doors of our house. And the houses were well raised up on embankments on either side of a sort of deep canal. And we could only get out and go down to the shopping area on little sampans or little flat-bottomed boats. And I was entranced. I loved this. A small boy would paddle down the street, you see, and every floating cabbage leaf or anything I saw, my mother used to say, I was to imitate the boats in the harbour. I'd say, "Ooh!"
Well, it sounds
automatic sound for ship's sirens, you see.
It sounds a charming life for a young boy, I must say.
Well, it was. Yeah. I mean, as children, we were very cosily brought up and very privately brought up in some ways.
Did you have any connection with the Navy, the Royal Navy? Would that have been an area they were involved with?
I didn't myself, but my father did, because he wore naval uniform of a sort. It was because for a time he was, well, it's difficult to explain, because I never quite figured out what he did. He'd been to sea all his life until he was well on into his 20s, and then he became a marine superintendent in his brother's firm in Hong Kong, but that was later. In the meantime, when he was in Tientsin, he was harbour master at Tientsin. And he also, before that, I believe, in fact, I got it wrong, actually. First of all, he was in charge of a Chinese customs cruiser, which was, of course, run by the British. The Chinese Imperialist Chinese Customs Service was British run, but he kept the Chinese Imperial name, that sort of thing. And he was, his job was anti-piracy duties out to sea and along the coast, and also he did a lot of admiralty surveys, checking on naval charts, which changed from time to time because of movement of sandbanks and things of that sort, especially as the Yellow Sea, which is very off which Beijing and Tientsin are situated. Enormous amount of mud would come down with the river, and so it was always changing on that bit of coast. But his navigational changing of charts and that extended as far as the Philippines. And so he, I'd say, that basin between China and the Philippines, which was south of Japan, I think he did a little bit along the Japanese coast, but they were very chary about it. Things of that sort. Japan was at war with China for centuries, as you know. And I do remember my father saying, when the Japanese come over to China to fight and stay, they end up being more Chinese than the Chinese themselves. It was a sort of cultural shock.
Well, thank you very much for telling me about your Chinese part of childhood.
I could tell you a little bit more.
Yes.
As an example, I got involved in a snowball fight with some older children, and they picked on me as the smallest boy. And some of the snowballs they threw, childish throws, of course, but had a certain amount of ice in them, and they were like rocks, and they hurt. And of course, I got very distressed and threw the snowballs back as hard as I could. And I was rescued by a most divine creature who arrived. And she picked me up in her arms and held me close to her. She was wearing a lovely warm fur coat, probably sable. And she smelled absolutely delicious, some kind of very exotic perfume. But the thing that I remember most about her was her extraordinary cobalt blue eyes. I had no idea who she was, but she spoke to the other boys very seriously and said, "Stop bullying this little boy," or something of that sort. I don't remember her exact words. What language she's speaking, but they got the message. And she hugged me and she put me down, and I ran away back to where I'd escaped from my armor. There were many Russian emigres at that time that had escaped the Bolshevik regime, good Russian families, and that. I would say she was probably one of those. And she was just taking an afternoon walk in a Russian park, as everybody did, and came across the scene.
Well, that's a fascinating glimpse of China from a young boy's
experience. Those sort of things.
Yes.
There was one other thing, I don't know if you want to put it in, actually. My mother, my eldest sister, who would have been my eldest sister, died shortly after infancy, in infancy, I should say. And she's buried, and her grave is still well tended, in the Happy Valley Cemetery in Hong Kong. I've seen it, and I've photographed it, and it's as good as new still. She was named after my mother, took my mother's Christian name, because she was not baptized. I don't remember if she was baptized or not, but the point is that she hadn't been named at that time, because it was only a few days after her birth that she died. As a result of which, when my mother became pregnant again about a year later, she was carrying me, she decided that she'd go home to England to avoid any repetition of what had happened before. And somehow, I don't remember the details, but she told me she caught a ship back to England. It was by now 1915, and she was very lucky to get through all right, but she was heavily pregnant by middle of 1915, went to relatives in North Essex, and before she got there, she gave birth to me in a train, just outside London. She was taken out of the train, and I was born in a house called the Eagle House, which is. I saw it about 20 years ago. It was still called Eagle House, which was then a sort of glorified nursing home hospital. And of course, it was in what was then Churchill's, one of Churchill's, what do you call it, things that,
one of his residences, would it be?
No, Churchill's. Have you seen a moment?
Yes.
Now and again, I cannot remember the name. That's the other thing. Constituency.
Oh, I know, yes.
And so this is how I came to be born in.
Wow. What a dramatic circumstance, having started the procedure on the train.
I don't know. I never got the full clinical detail thing.
I think that's really fine to know that.
But she was able again to fluke a passage back to Hong Kong.
With you?
With me, as an infant, after about 6 months, and rejoined my father in China.
That was in the middle of World War I, wasn't it? Yes.
Again, she had a little problem feeding me. And that was another way. So I was brought up with a Chinese wet nurse until I was weaned. I don't know if you want all that, but that.
Well, yes, it's very interesting information, because it does give a glimpse of, that China at that particular time.
Explains my specificity.
But I'm now going to ask you about your return to the UK for your education.
There's a lot more about China.
Is it? I beg your pardon, yes.
The the first time when things really became made more sense to me, I remember, was that we moved away south. Before that, every summer we used to go to the coast for a holiday, and I'll read this bit out because I just.
Yes, or if you could just refer to it, you know, that would be even better. We have to be careful about rustle, because it does cut out your voice. The rustle of the paper, if you wouldn't mind, you know, because we're at the early stages of the interview, and I don't want to start it.
No. Well, for a part of every summer, we went to Shanghai Quan, and to Peter Ho, now called Beda Hei, or to Wei Hai Wei to escape the heat. Peter Ho had many fine sandy beaches, and it was and still is a Western style seaside resort. I don't remember ever being taught to swim. It seemed to have come naturally to me from the time I first repeatedly jumped into the sea off the end of a small beach jetty in front of our hotel, following the antics of older boys, and I dog paddled back to the shore. Shanghai Quan was an ancient walled town at the crumbling eastern end of the Great Wall of China, near where it meets the sea. And many were the times in the early 1920s when my brother and sister and I played and picnicked on it.
On the Great Wall?
The end of the Great Wall. It was a historical frontier between China and Manchuria, and its main landmark was a massive gate with the inscription, "First Pass Under Heaven," painted boldly on it in English and in Mandarin. A few miles to the east, there was a small temple commemorating a tragic folk heroine, Meng Yangnu. She was the bride of a man conscripted by the first emperor of Qin to work on the wall. After many years of separation, she went to look for him, only to find his bones, like those of many others, embedded in the Great Wall. She committed suicide by jumping into the sea. The temple which was built in her memory dates back to the 16th century. Some 65 to 70 years later, I revisited different parts of China several times that I had once known, including what is now known or termed the municipality of Tianjin, but commonly is still better known as Tientsin. It has none of the tourist attractions of other Chinese cities with longer historical associations, but it was a fascinating city to revisit, with its modern post-revolution buildings, which blended haphazardly with Treaty Port French Rococo, Italian Art Deco, and British suburban style architecture. Around the old city centre, with its dilapidated temples and commemorative arches, there were restaurants which offered superb seafood dishes, and there was an old Viennese coffee shop and restaurant known as Kieslin, formerly Kieslings, which served Western-style food upstairs, and downstairs offered coffee and biscuits amidst marble tables, mirrors, and potted plants. In the 1980s, Tientsin was still well known for two things: its dumplings, filled with a paste known as gubuli, which literally means even dogs won't eat, and its quick-witted mercantile inhabitants, who spoke their own colloquial form of Mandarin.
Well, I think we'll get you to England now, if that's okay. We can drop the papers, if that's all right.
Yes. I sometimes hesitate because I know what I'm saying. Let me just give me a chance to if you want to switch it off. It's an aid memoir to me, really. I get it. There came a time when my father was transferred from Tientsin to Hong Kong, where he set up in business with his brother, who had been there some time before him. And at first we stayed at the Peak Hotel, which I remember is a very cold place because it was well above 700 feet, probably higher than the bottom half. And we had to go up to it by a rack railway, which was always very exciting for a young boy. Then we moved down to Repulse Bay, which was delightful. And it was at that time that my father decided to send all of us home to England for our education. Picking up other things, yeah.
Yes, so this is when you came back to England for your education. So that must have been a great contrast for you, wasn't it?
I seemed to take it all in one stride. I don't remember very much about the voyage, but I do remember the ship. It was a blue funnel line. And blue funnels are rather unusual in the Merchant Navy. And it was called the Holt line. The ship was called the Pyrrhus. I always remember the name Pyrrhus. The whole line, they named all their ships after Greek. Must be neighbour.
Yes, I think I what I'll do is stop this here.